Hello all, and welcome to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. Today, for our Thanksgiving show, we will be exploring themes of consumption and trade. After some news, we'll start with an interview with local resident Trudy Anderson about the Hunger Project. Then we'll hear an interview with another area resident who participated in the WTO Seattle protests, a historic event which happened 5 years ago this coming Tuesday. Our second hour, again with Thanksgiving in mind, will focus on Native American issues, including excerpts from this year's Day of Mourning event in Plymouth, Mass. As usual, we'll also have music and announcements. Let's go now to Steve Diamond with the news.
Last weekend was the annual School of the Americas protest at Fort Benning, Georgia. From a report at the Atlanta IMC, a number of activists and performers spoke out against the School of the Americas through the day Saturday, and all returned to the theme of perseverance and solidarity. Despite forecasts of rain, the crowd of thousands explored vendors and literature tables and listened to the speakers and musical guests, including religious leaders such as Reverend Grayland Hagler, Sister Helen Prejean, the writer of Dead Man Walking, and Susan Sarandon, who played her in the movie of the same name. The audience also enjoyed a performance by the Puppetistas, who worked with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, CIA, in designing the show this year, with the theme, A Better World is Under Construction. In other news, GOP convention protesters sue over cop brutality claims, from the Associated Press. Protesters, bystanders, and legal observers arrested during the Republican National Convention filed a lawsuit Monday alleging their constitutional rights were violated. The lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Manhattan sought class action status on behalf of nearly 2,000 arrested during the convention and unspecified damages for physical and mental pain and anguish. The lawsuit alleged that the city engaged in mass arrests and created a system of preventative detention to keep peaceful demonstrators off the streets during the height of the convention. It said those arrested were subjected to, quote, intolerable and cruel and inhumane conditions, including denying them access to family and lawyers for an unreasonable amount of time. The alleged victims of the city policies included a 15-year-old diabetic who was arrested as she tried to go to a movie on 34th Street, and a former vice president of Morgan Stanley who was arrested as she rode her bicycle lawfully. Those arrested in late August and early September were subjected to long detention, awaiting court appearances in filthy makeshift jails, including an old bus terminal, where oily floors caused rashes and burns, the lawsuit alleged. Many of those arrested were subjected to excessively tight handcuffing that caused them numbness, pain, and extreme discomfort, the lawsuit said. Quote, the criminalization of dissent and protest lies at the heart of the defendant's mass arrest policy, the lawsuit said. Congress approves anti-abortion clause. From The Guardian. America's religious right has scored its first legislative victory since George Bush's re-election by inserting a clause into a spending bill to undermine state laws requiring hospitals to provide abortions. The provision, a last-minute addition to the $388 billion budget bill, was approved by Congress without debate on the weekend in one of its last acts of its legislative session. It is expected soon to be signed into law by President Bush. The passage of the bill caps a 2-year campaign by Catholic bishops and anti-abortion organizations to give legal cover to hospitals that refuse to perform terminations or to even refer women to abortion providers. The country's largest anti-abortion group described the bill's passage as one of its most important legal victories. The triumph for the religious right was condemned by Democratic senators and women's activists as a clandestine attempt to chisel away at abortion rights. Few members were even aware of the clause when the bill was brought to Congress on Saturday, and by then it was too late to block it. After an uproar from Democrats, it was agreed that the Senate would hold a vote to repeal the measure in April. From Reuters, the Pentagon is losing the war for Muslim minds. The U.S. is losing the war of ideas in the Islamic world, failing to promote its policies to Muslims wary of American intentions and self-serving hypocrisy, a Pentagon advisory panel, the Defense Science Board, has found in a report made available on Wednesday. The board said, If we really want to see the Muslim world as a whole, and the Arabic-speaking world in particular, move more toward our understanding of moderation and tolerance, we must reassure Muslims that this does not mean that they must submit to the American way. The toughly worded report said that while America's efforts to explain its policies have failed, improved public relations efforts cannot sell faulty policies. Muslims do not hate our freedom, but rather they hate our policies, the panel stated. The overwhelming majority voiced their objections to what they see as one-sided support in favor of Israel and against Palestinian rights, and the long-standing, even increasing, support for what Muslims collectively see as tyrannies, most notably Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Pakistan, and the Gulf states. Thus, when American public diplomacy talks about bringing democracy to Islamic societies, this is seen as no more than self-serving hypocrisy, the report stated. The Bush administration has portrayed the war in Iraq, launched last year, as a mission to bring democracy to that country in the hope that it could serve as a model to others in the Middle East. U.S. intervention in the Muslim world, including wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, have actually elevated the stature of radical enemies of America, the report stated. In the eyes of Muslims, American occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan have not led to democracy there, but only more chaos and suffering. U.S. actions appear, in contrast, to be motivated by ulterior motives and deliberately controlled in order to best serve American national interests at the expense of truly Muslim self-determination, the report stated. On the BBC, farewell to Fallujah. As U.S. forces are consolidating their hold over the Iraqi city of Fallujah, the BBC News spoke by phone to Fadil Badrani, an Iraqi journalist and resident of Fallujah who reports regularly for Reuters and the BBC World News in Arabic. Here is one of several eyewitness reports submitted by Badrani. I think I'm very lucky to have survived these last few months. I still remember how I celebrated Eid this year, with bombardment and the sound of gunfire. Coming with the new moon, the festival marks the end of Ramadan. I shall never forget how the people left behind in the city helped each other. I became very close to those I shared the house with. Each of us knew that if death came, it would probably come to all of us, at any instant. We could all be finished off by the same bomb. Fallujah was not a poor city compared to many others in Iraq, but many of its homes are now dust. Hardly a single one among those still standing is unscarred by war. Wherever you look, there are bullet holes, fire damage, and massive holes missing from the walls. Many people used to cultivate flowers in their gardens. The roses have wilted, the backyards are graveyards. My old house, near the train station, is half destroyed. I had built an office to one side of it, which had a library with all my books, documents, professional certificates, and newspapers. All this is gone. It got bombed. A report from the Los Angeles Times. Guardsmen say they're facing Iraq ill-trained. Doña Ana Range, New Mexico. Members of a California Army National Guard battalion preparing for deployment to Iraq said this week that they were under strict lockdown and being treated like prisoners rather than soldiers by Army commanders at the remote desert camp where they are training. More troubling, a number of the soldiers said, is that the training they have received is so poor and equipment shortages so prevalent that they fear their casualty rate will be needlessly high when they arrive in Iraq early next year. "We're going to pay for this in blood," one soldier said. The 680 soldiers of the 1st Battalion of the 184th Infantry Regiment were activated in August and are preparing for deployment at Doña Ana, a former World War II prisoner of war camp 20 miles west of its large parent base, Fort Bliss, Texas. Members of a battalion headquartered in Modesto said in 24 interviews that they were allowed no visitors or travel passes, had scant contact with their families, and the morale was terrible. Said Corporal Jane Smith, 31, a 6-year Guard veteran from Fresno who works for an armored transport company when not on active duty, "I feel like an inmate with a weapon." Several soldiers have fled Doña Ana by vaulting over rolls of barbed wire that surround the small camp, the soldiers interviewed said. Others, they said, are contemplating going AWOL, at least temporarily. Army commanders said the concerns were an inevitable result of the decision to shore up the strained military by turning citizen soldiers into fully integrated frontline combat troops. About 40% of the troops in Iraq are either reservists or National Guard troops. In September, a National Guard battalion undergoing accelerated training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, was confined to barracks for 2 weeks after 13 soldiers reportedly went AWOL to see family before shipping out for Iraq. Last month, an Army National Guard platoon at Camp Shelby, Mississippi, refused its orders after voicing concerns about training conditions and poor leadership. In the most highly publicized incident in October, more than 24 Army reservists in Iraq refused to drive a fuel convoy to a town north of Baghdad after arguing that the trucks they had been given were not armored for combat duty. At Danya Ana, soldiers have questioned their commanders about conditions at the camp, occasionally breaking the protocol of formation drills to do so. They said they had been told repeatedly that they could not be trusted because they were not active duty soldiers, though many of them are former active duty soldiers. Military analysts have questioned whether the soldiers' concerns could be attributed entirely to the military's attempt to mirror conditions in Iraq. For example, the soldiers said that an ammunition shortage has meant that they have been often conducting operations firing blanks. Jonathan Turley, a George Washington University law professor, has acted as defense lawyer in the military courts. He said, "The Bush administration had over a year of planning before going to war in Iraq. An ammunition shortage is not an exercise in tough love." The Guard troops in New Mexico said they wanted more sophisticated training and better equipment. They said they had been told, for example, that the vehicles they would drive in Iraq would not be armored, a common complaint among their counterparts already serving overseas. The soldiers said they had received little or no training for operations that they expected to undertake in Iraq, from convoy protection to guarding against insurgents' roadside bombs. One said he had put together a diary of what he called wasted days of training. It listed 95 days, he said, during which the soldiers learned nothing that would prepare them for Iraq. One National Guard veteran of 20 years and father of two said, "Some of us are going to die there, and some of us are going to die unnecessarily because of the lack of training. So I don't care. Let them court-martial me. I want the American public to know what is going on. My men are guilty of one thing, volunteering to serve their country, and we are at the end of our rope." And they haven't even gotten to Iraq. Now let's go to an interview by Amy Antonucci.
During the holiday season, a couple days after Thanksgiving, food, consumption, giving, and getting are issues on our minds. I'm here in Studio 318 with Trudy Anderson of Kittery, Maine, to talk about the Hunger Project. The Hunger Project is a global organization committed to ending world hunger. Welcome, Trudy.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Could you start off by telling us a bit about the Hunger Project and what it does?
Yes, I'm happy to do that. The Hunger Project began in 1977 as a commitment to end chronic, persistent hunger in the world in areas where there is a higher infant mortality rate of more than 50 per thousand live births. The Hunger Project operates and has programs on the ground in South Asia, Bangladesh, 8 African countries, and 3 countries in South America. And one of the things I'd like to talk about is that when we speak of the principles of ending hunger, it's really important to consider the way you look at ending hunger. And I'd invite everybody to take a look at this. What we've found in the Hunger Project is that it's possible to create the end of hunger as a goal and still have thinking that's inconsistent with actually ending it. It's possible to be committed to the end of hunger and have in your head a kind of charitable thinking that if you took action consistent with this, you would not create sustainably the end of hunger. The Hunger Project is about being beyond charity. And we don't want to give charity a bad rap because there are many wonderful charitable causes. What we're trying to say is there's a lot of thinking on the planet that we feel that if we're helping someone who's less fortunate than ourselves, and we've seen it on academic papers that say there are 1 billion mouths to feed, And our president, Joan Holmes, wrote this person who said that, who was from a prestigious educational institution. She said, please don't say that. There are not a billion mouths to feed. There are a billion souls and human spirits to unleash for the end of hunger. That's the issue. And when we continue to speak of people like baby birds with the mouths to feed, the only thing that we can feel is paralysis in reference to that problem. It's bigger than that. How about empowering people to unleash the human spirit for the end of hunger? That's the issue. So the Hunger Project is an empowerment paradigm.
That's great. It reminds me of a bumper sticker I've seen that says, charity is nice, but justice is better.
Ah, that's great.
Well, let's talk about hunger a bit. Could you tell me how is it that hunger is defined by the Hunger Project?
Yes. When we think of hunger, we often think of famine and where people have a severe problem in not being able to get enough food. We have found that on the planet, famine only accounts for 8% of the hunger. 92% of the hunger is chronic, persistent hunger, which actually kills 20,000 people a day, which is down from 41,000 people per day dying from hunger-related causes in 1977 when the Hunger Project began its work. Hunger arises when people lack the opportunities to earn money, to produce food. It results when women are severely subjugated, and in developing countries, women and girls are severely limited from their opportunity to be educated. And recently the Hunger Project focused on the girl child globally at the big event in New York, right, the weekend of November 6th. So it's not an issue of food. Hunger is not, there's way more food in the world, right, than is needed for people to be adequately nourished.
So it's more a social system justice issue than simply passing food out to people.
Exactly. It's not passing food out. It's failed economic policies. It's corruption. It's so many other related areas.
Yes, as a person who's done a lot of work on anti-corporate globalization projects, that's very consistent with the information I've seen.
Yes. Yeah. And the Hunger Project works with the grassroots. It's not top down. It's meeting with people for them to see what's missing, what is so first in their community, and what is missing. So we don't go, the Hunger Project doesn't go to places where there's severe hunger and say, you need to do this or that or the other. We're there to stand with them as they create their solutions. And one of the major methodologies in the Hunger Project is a workshop called the Vision, Commitment, and Action Workshop, where the people themselves, we consider the people living in conditions of severe hunger the solution and not the problem.
That's a great way to go about it.
Yeah.
Can you say more about what does happen on the ground when the hunger pot, how do you get into communities and how do you work with them a little bit more?
Well, first of all, there has to be some willingness to allow volunteers and staff for the Hunger Project to go into a country. So there has to be some commitment on the part of the gatekeepers to allow the Hunger Project to go there. And the first thing is just to meet with people. Meet with people. We do ask that women be represented, and sometimes this is a challenge. In some places, women have not been allowed to participate. So we keep saying we'd like to have some women represented. And we just meet with people and listen. We don't tell them anything. That we don't go there to teach. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'd like to just mention something. There's a statement, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach him to fish, you Feeding for Life. We do not need to teach Indigenous peoples how to fish. They have centuries of wisdom about fishing. But perhaps a law that inhibits or prevents women from fishing, or the barbed wire around the fishing ponds needs to be removed. So the first thing to do is just to meet with the people, to listen and have them determine what is missing, what is their vision, where are they going to get into action. That's basically how it operates. And it's dynamic and it's shifting and changing all the time. There's a real movement now for things to expand in the Hunger Project. That's why Andy, my husband, and I are so excited about working with the Hunger Project now. Because I knew about it when it first started in the early years, and we were just doing educational briefings about where hunger is. But now there's so much going on with, and in India, the local governing councils, the panchayats, there's a new law that was recently passed that 1/3 of all those elected officials must be women. I think Mahatma Gandhi had a lot to do with what's going on what's going on there. So meeting with the people, determining what's so, what's missing, that's basically how it starts. You know, the website for the Hunger Project is really great for learning about what's going on and anything you want to know. And it's www.thp.org. Also, there's another website, www.hungerproject.org. And our president, Joan Holmes, was recently appointed to the Millennium Task Force on Ending Hunger. And there's information about those developments on the website.
Great. Those great resources. I understand that you were at the conference on the girl child.
Yes.
Was just a couple weeks ago.
Yes, it was the weekend of November 6th in New York City. And that information is on the website as well. And what was brought to light was the treatment of girls and women on our planet is the greatest violation of human rights in history. And Joan Holmes, the president's speech or address to the people is all on the website. I did bring a copy, but people can read it on the website.
Can you say more about, I know you've said a number of times about how gender issues, how subjugation of women is so key to ending hunger.
Yes.
Is there more you can say about that, about what sorts of patterns?
Well, in terms of conflicts, women have the least voice and they're most affected by war, by destructive environmental practices. 80% of the world's refugees are women and children. And so there is a focus, there has been a strong focus in the last, I would say, 4 to 6 years on the empowerment of women. And some people get the idea the Hunger Project is just a women's movement. No, it's standing in true partnership, men and women as equals, which, I mean, the planet will look entirely different when men and women are truly equal, honoring each other's gifts and working together for a better world for all, men, women, and children.
Mm-hmm. I also understand that you've done some traveling to some of the countries that the Hunger Project
works in. Yes. In 1998, I learned about the Hunger Project's plan to honor the women food farmers of Africa at the Africa Prize, which has been given for outstanding leadership in Africa for the sustainable end of hunger since 1987. Many leaders had been given this prize. In 1999, it was awarded to the Women of Africa. So I went to the event in New York City at the Global Office, and then I actually went on 2 investor trips. When we give to the Hunger Project, we call ourselves investors because we're investing in a better future for all humanity. So I went first of all to Benin, which if however you pronounce the pronunciation is, in West Africa with my husband Andy. And then I went subsequently to Senegal to see the work on the ground. It was a joyful celebration. Some people had walked all night to get there, and we saw their farms. They have what's called an epicenter, which is a center that has a clinic, a school, literacy classes, microcredit banking, and we got to see their centers, which may serve 20,000 people who come from surrounding villages to the epicenter. And it was, these people are not sad, and they're joyful, and the Hunger Project is very well known in the media. It's on the front pages of their papers. So in the countries where the Hunger Project operates, there's great media coverage. I'd love it if we had some media coverage on our major newspapers in America, and that's probably coming. But and when I got back to the U.S., something happened to me. I think I experienced a poverty of wealth where, you know, sometimes we have so much stuff, we're buried in our stuff, and some of our human values are, I don't even know how to express this, but I really miss being there and the joy that I experienced and how much is happening that's positive in a time when a lot of times people are discouraged now because things don't seem to be going great globally. But with the Hunger Project, so much is going on that's great.
It sounds like one thing that you saw in your travels was, or that you did in your travels, was really connect with the people and help develop the sense of working with rather than giving to them.
Yes, it is a shared partnership. Standing shoulder to shoulder with the people who live in conditions of hunger. We tend to think that there are people less than ourselves often, and, you know, we haven't found any. They're not in Africa, they're not in Asia. We just haven't found any. We have found people who were resource poor. There's no question. In Bangladesh, for example, at some of the meetings, some of the women couldn't come out because they didn't even have one sari to wear. So we sat outside the hut to speak, and it was translated. So they didn't have the resources, but it wasn't that they were less than us. They were human spirits, and with creativity and vision and dreams. You know, so that to me is a big distinction of the Hunger Project. It's our connectedness as a human family.
I understand that there's been a lot of work done in Bangladesh. Could you say a little more about what's happening there?
Yes. In Bangladesh, local democracy has been strengthened. In more than 200 clusters of villages with a total population of more than 4 million, we carry out a 10-point women-centered strategy to empower communities to end hunger through local democracy. And we seized the opportunity this year of new local elections and began providing an intensive 4-day training to newly elected local officials. There's another thing I'd like to mention right here, if I may. In all the projects of the Hunger Project, where the Hunger Project works, it's all indigenous leadership. Almost all the work in the Hunger Project is done by volunteers like we are. Globally, there's only 125 paid staff, and in the countries where it operates, it's always indigenous leadership. And they, on a very small budget of perhaps $40,000, can have 6 people working there, where that wouldn't even pay the salary of one American going over there.
Right.
So that's a huge difference in the Hunger Project's
way
of operating. I want to tell you about a woman who has really inspired me, and I know her from the videos that we show, actually showing the work of the Hunger Project. That's what my husband and I do. We invite people over to a 90-minute program, which includes about an hour of video on the Hunger Project. The person I'm speaking of is a woman from Karnataka, India. Her name is Muda Erika. She was a woman who took the Women's Leadership Workshop in Bangalore in India. It totally transformed her life. She never was able to speak up, but she decided she had a vision for her community. So the vision was that there was water in her village, clean water, that the people had basic housing needs met, and basic health care needs, including the boys and the girls. And often health and education was denied to the girls. Well, she took the workshop along with several hundred other women and realized that she was going to keep fighting for what she believed in. And she actually was successful in her work with speaking to the engineers, block developers, the leaders in her village. And she did not give up. And she told the Hunger Project that she wouldn't come to the event in New York honoring the women of South Asia unless there was water in her village. And in New York, she announced that she could say she was there because there is now water in her village. It's clean water.
What an amazing success.
Yes.
Could you say now a little more about how to get involved in the gatherings that you and Andy have?
Yes, we would like to leave our phone number. Our phone number, we live in Kittery, it's 207-439-0428. And we invite people to also go to the website, which I said before, I'll say it again, it's www.thp.org. And there is another website which includes Joan Holmes' work with the United Nations Millennium Hunger Project. That's www.hungerproject.org. And we're pleased to have people come for a 90-minute program. We prefer to speak to small groups so that people can get their questions answered, they can comment, and we always, at those gatherings, we do invite people to invest in the work of the Hunger Project, and we primarily want people to learn about what is going on with the Hunger Project. And for those who are committed that hunger can end, we'd love to have you get in touch with us.
And I think a lot of people are looking for projects and ways to bring solutions, and it sounds like the Hunger Project is offering that. So again, can you say your phone number so
yes.
people can?
Yes, 207-439-0428.
Thank you so much for coming here, Trudy. It was great talking with you.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
This Tuesday, November 30th, marks the 5-year anniversary of the protests against the World Trade Organization meeting in Seattle. In that action, thousands of protesters who took to the streets succeeded in shutting down the WTO meetings. Official ceremonies were canceled and the trade talks collapsed as chaos erupted throughout the city. More than 500 demonstrators were arrested, and many more people were subjected to harsh treatment by law enforcement. One of those people joins us now. Leonie Luderman of Amesbury, Massachusetts, has seen a lot. She's the mother of 6, stepmother to 4. She was a Roman Catholic nun. She was later married to the president of the U.S. branch of Christian Dior. Nowadays, she's remarried and is a practicing Buddhist. Leonie joined the Seattle protest at the invitation of her daughter, who's also named Leonie. Another daughter, Megan, who was 16 at the time, joined them at her insistence. Leonie, this is your first participation in a demonstration as a protester. Is that right?
Yes, it's certainly the first one that I was deeply involved in. And my daughter has been an activist for a long time, and she prepared me completely for this one. So it was very different from anything else I've been involved in.
And did you have any idea what you'd be facing in Seattle?
Well, it's one thing to have an idea, and it's another thing to actually take a body hit. I assumed that we could be arrested. I assumed that we might be tear gassed. I didn't know about pepper spray, and I certainly didn't have a clue about rubber bullets.
And you encountered both during your experience there?
All of them. We spent the weekend being trained in nonviolence, and that was wonderful. My daughter Lanny was a teacher, and She used my younger daughter and myself as guinea pigs, but we learned how not to react violently, and we learned how to do legal solidarity, and we learned how to handle tear gas and what helped pepper spray. But there was never any mention that rubber bullets might be used.
I'd like to ask you what the plan of action was for the protest that you did and what ended up happening.
My daughter and I flew to Seattle, where my older daughter was being prepared to hang a banner on I-5, and I knew that. She was going to be secretly whisked over to the site and hang a banner, and then we were going to be taken to where she was. So I knew that part of the plan. I knew that she would probably be arrested, and my younger daughter and I were to be the point person people for the media, and I knew that. Then I also knew that we were going to be divided into affinity groups, which is something I'd never heard of, but was an absolutely wonderful non-hierarchical way to do it. And my wish was that whatever we did would be significant. I didn't want to be there and sort of be on the fringes. So again, I knew that our group, our particular affinity group, would be given a task and an area. We had the city divided in sort of a pie with lots of segments and where we were each going to be. And they were very, very organized about it. So I had a vague idea, but I don't think you can ever really prepare for something like that. It's too chaotic and too unpredictable on the ground. But I knew that much.
And so on the day of the protest itself, you were sort of given... taken to the place that you're going to do the action, and then what ended up happening when you got there?
Well, we got our marching orders that day, and I still remember getting dressed that morning, because you wear different clothes when you're protesting. You know, you don't want any identification on you, but you can't be without it, so it sort of goes in your socks or something, and we have to be warm. And so we were scared getting dressed, and we knew what our marching orders were, and I honestly can't remember the name of the street, but we were told that we were going to go to this particular street and sit down and block it. And it turned out to be Ground Zero. Our street turned out to be the first one that actually came into conflict with the police. And we sat down on the ground and we linked arms. People who went to Seattle had different roles. Some were willing to be arrested, some weren't. Some were there to cheer up the people who were sitting on the ground. Other people were there to bring us tea and coffee, and others were there to dance and sing songs and all the rest of it. It was wonderful how everybody's talents were used. But we got to the site and we sat down on the road and we started making sort of a community among us. And we were pretty quickly backed up by, or behind us pretty quickly, came armored vehicles, men, they looked like Ninja Turtles. I don't know how else to say it. You know, they had boots that went up above the knee, and they had so many guns and things attached to them, and huge helmets. You couldn't see their faces, and big shoulder pads, and they were very, very scary looking. And they were behind us, and at one point there were also horses, people on horseback behind us. And I was scared, thinking that the horses were going to take off on us. And one of the fellow protesters said, "The horses are on our side." And we didn't have any trouble from the horses, but it was scary. It was really scary. And at one point, before the action actually started, there were four policemen who walked up the road towards us, clearly intent on breaking our line. And I think at that point we were standing, so we decided to all sit. And we all sat. And it just happened that the policeman on the end of it hit me. I mean, he came in and he kneed me in the face with his boot and sort of walked over me. And that was fine. We were really trained in nonviolence, and I was perfectly cool with that. However, my 16-year-old daughter was apoplectic. And it was a real practice for all of us to say, you know, you can't react to this either. It's much easier when it happens to you than to watch it being done to someone you love. And then about 20 minutes later, they'd asked us to disperse, and someone went on a mic and said, "If you don't disperse in 5 minutes, we will use chemical weapons." And I thought I'd heard wrong. But no, No, that's what he said. And the one of the support people knew that I had asthma and that a pepper spray for me would be very bad. And she said to the policeman, this woman has asthma. And he said, get her out of there. And my daughters and I had decided that we wouldn't leave unless we all decided to leave. And we didn't want to leave, so we stayed. So 5 minutes later, it was incredible. The men behind us, I don't think were further than 5 feet away. Let's give them 8 feet. You know, let's say 8 feet. I don't think it was 8 feet, but let's say 8 feet. And they used pepper spray on my scarf. They saturated my scarf. Someone just came by and did that. And tear gas. And then they shot us with rubber bullets. And I'm so naive and so slow in the uptake, I didn't know what it was. I had this tremendous pain in my back. And I just kept saying, that really hurts. And my younger daughter, who's smarter than I am, said, those were bullets. Those were rubber bullets. So we waited until we were hit a second and a third time. And then between the tear gas and the pepper spray, which keeps you from breathing, we fled. We all just left. And it was absolute chaos. And we just ran away trying to get someplace where we could get fresh air. My younger daughter was almost overcome and retching and wanted to just curl into a ball and hide in the door to a shop. And we wouldn't let her. We dragged her until we could get her to fresh air. And we did recuperate. We did breathe again. And we, you know, and our eyes cleared. And we didn't want to leave the area. So we stayed that day and we protested everywhere we could. And we came back for 2 days after that before we had to fly home. We weren't hit with rubber bullets again, but we saw terrible things going on. And one of the things that concerned us the most was there was a band of about 12 people dressed completely in black who were going through the city destroying things, breaking windows, turning over newspaper things, and they were never, never confronted by the police. Never. They were given absolutely free rein. And we tried to go behind them cleaning up what they'd done because that's not what we were about. But that's what, you know, gave the protest such a bad name. You know, they sort of tarred us with that brush. And it was horrific that they were completely left alone. And no one tried to stop them. And yet the people who were demonstrating nonviolently, we were the ones who got pepper spray and tear gassed and shot with rubber bullets. It was amazing.
Did any of the organizers... Or do you know, did anyone have a explanation of who these people were and why they were given free rein?
They were anarchists, and they came as anarchists, and they came with this agenda. And people knew enough about it that the photographers could get close-up pictures of them for the newspaper, but the police never went near them. I think it was to their benefit to have this happen so that they could charge us all with that kind of behavior.
I remember hearing from some folks, you know, well after the event that they thought that these might have been, you know, agents sent in to deliberately, you know, provoke not only the police but also public reaction against the entire protest. Do you think there's any truth to that? Or
it's hard to believe that there isn't some truth to it. So much bad stuff happened that it's, and they were so immune to police reaction that it's not hard to believe that that could have been a part of it. My experience was that the Seattle police were the ones who were truly scared, truly unprepared, not properly trained, and very anxious to use all the, you know, guns and whistles and stuff that they had. My experience with the SWAT team was that they were professionals and they didn't use excessive force. But the Seattle police were truly scary. And they were actually ripping people's gas masks off and spraying them with pepper spray. That's horrific. It's a kind of meanness that was stunning. I just didn't expect.
And I wonder, you know, coming out of that experience, if that changed your view of state power or the media, for that matter, in terms of how the thing was portrayed and what the reality was like being on the ground there.
It certainly destroyed my ability to believe the mainstream media. And I think the biggest thing there was we were there. We were absolutely there. And the next morning, we read the paper and the front page of the Seattle papers, and it was not our experience at all. They didn't mention rubber bullets. They didn't mention that we were nonviolent. It was so untrue. It was so blatantly untrue that I can't read the paper the same anymore. I just can't. As far as state power goes, my take on them is that they were truly, truly, truly acting out of fear. And that's a terrible poison. It leads us to do all kinds of things that we wouldn't do normally. I don't think it's a plot. I think it's a very human sentiment that can color a lot of our actions. And again, you've mentioned that I'm a practicing Buddhist. I'm trying very hard to listen deeply to contrary opinions. And I think until we can do that, the fear is going to take over. And we will act in ways that are self-destructive, counterproductive, violating of other people's rights. But understanding that another person is coming out of fear, I think, is an important insight and keeps you from unnecessary or a kind of reaction that isn't helpful.
And in that light, looking at the nature of politics today and how divided we as a nation seem to be, I wonder, given your perspective and your spiritual study and experience, how you see the nature of duality, or the sort of falsity of the appearance of duality, and how that intersects with politics and such passions and differences of not only opinion, but how reality is apparently constructed in people's minds.
It's a tough one. Thich Nhat Hanh is a Vietnamese Buddhist who talks a lot about living Buddhist values in politics and real life. And the most important thing that I get out of his teachings is the need to listen deeply to people who have opinions that I don't share. And it's a sort of fundamental humility to do that, to sort of let go of your own axe that you want to grind and be able to be truly open to other people's views, impressions, perceptions, to understand where they are and where they're coming from. And that's the only way I can think of to get rid of this us and them mentality, which is completely destructive of the best that's in humanity. It's completely destructive, I think, once you start seeing the world or groups as enemies and you've lost your commonality. It's very unskillful. It's very destructive. So I see the country as tremendously divided right now. But I know that in my own life, it's difficult for me to be open to people who are very happy at the results of the election, for instance. And the challenge for me just in my own life is to be able to truly engage them in conversation without judgment, and to be able to hear what they're saying with a view to understanding it, rather than castigating them or changing them. Because I think until I can hear them without judgment, I don't have a chance of sort of blending this divide or destroying the divide. So I think the task for me personally is to learn how to do that. And I think it's something the country needs to do. And I don't know how you get there from here, except to have an awareness of the divisions that have been created, how destructive they are, and a real desire to find another way that is more supportive of the best that we are.
And, some people who are deeply spiritual or deeply religious take a tack in their life where they disengage from politics, from social action, and so on. And I know that there's a school of thought within Buddhism that's very socially engaged, and I believe there are other schools that aren't so much. And I wonder sort of how you see that in your own life.
I think the ones, I don't know a great deal about this. I do know that no matter what, how active I am or how passionate I am about my beliefs, if I don't take time off every once in a while to be quiet and to be still and to be removed from the fray, I lose my objectivity and I lose my clarity. I lose my balance. So there certainly is a need for those who are activists to take time out. My take on the Buddhist schools that do not engage in social action is that they feel very powerfully the need to transform themselves before they can be of benefit to others. There are, of course, other schools that say, don't wait for that. You know, don't wait until you're a bodhisattva or until you're enlightened to do good. Do it all at once. You know, you've really got to experience nirvana and samsara at the same time. The difficulty with engaged anything is I need to be very clear on my motives. I need to not be blinded by my own belief system. I need to be open to other people's views. And I need to heal divisions rather than create them. So even in activism, I need to do that. Once I start thinking in terms of us and them, I've turned a very dark corner and can do a lot of damage. So the practice, the personal practice, is not to let that happen, to see us all as one and to be able to listen without judgment. That's quite a difficult practice, but I don't think we can be helpful in the long run without it.
And looking back at your experience in Seattle, would you, if you knew now what was going to happen to you and your daughters while you were there, would you do it again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I would have warned our friends back home not to watch the news while we were there, because it's one thing to be caught up in it and engaged in it and committed to it. That's the easy part. Watching somebody you love be tear gassed or pepper sprayed or shot with rubber bullets is extraordinarily difficult. But I wouldn't have missed it for the world. And I there are lots of other situations where I would be willing to do it again. I'd like to be a little bit more prepared for the pepper spray. It really is bad on my asthma. I certainly would wear a backpack and maybe even a front pack for the rubber bullet thing. But there certainly are causes that require witnessing and require nonviolent witnessing. My aim in going to Seattle wasn't just to shut down the WTO. It was to put it on the map. It was to put it on people's consciousness. It was to bring the focus of the media and the world to it, because I saw it as a sort of very clandestine, shrouded in secrecy kind of very powerful organization, and I felt people should know about it. There are a lot of issues that are possible that will require that kind of witness again, and I wouldn't miss it for anything.
I'd like to step back in time and talk about your experience as a nun. How did that come about, and how come you ended up leaving the order that you were a part of?
It's a sort of intimate question, and I don't mind trying to answer it. I grew up in a family that was not particularly religious at all, and when I was very young, I developed a relationship with Christ. I don't know how else to say it. I was quite unhappy as a child, and that was sort of my access to joy and to being loved unconditionally. And it was quite powerful. And when I was 13, I discovered that you could give your whole life over to that relationship. So from that time on, I wanted to live that life. And the only way I could think of to live it was as a nun. So I ultimately entered a contemplative Benedictine order in Boulder, Colorado. I was only there for a year, but we lived on a farm. We lived in silence most of the time. We chanted the Divine Office, the Psalms, 7 times a day in Latin, and I absolutely loved it. I felt as if I were a helium balloon just floating up to the sky. But then there came a time when I wanted more silence and I wanted more study. I was the only American woman who had had 3 years of college. It was mostly a German order. As a matter of fact, Lilies of the Field is a movie that I've never seen, but it was about my community in Colorado. And when I asked my superior if I could write to another convent to ask, or another monastery to ask about more study and more silence, she said, "You either belong here, or you should leave altogether." So I left, but it was a very sudden decision. That meeting was on a Sunday. I left on a Wednesday, and I never lost the yearning to find something larger than my own particular self and image that would be of benefit to all beings, that would allow you to live in a way of, or from a place of indiscriminate compassion. That's really what I was after. And I found it in my relationship with Christ. I was a Roman Catholic for many, many years, and I found that my own experience as a Roman Catholic is that access was sort of blocked. And I became an Episcopalian, where as a woman I had much more visibility. And I preached and I taught and I mentored and I did all those good things. I just wasn't nurtured. I acted sort of in a ministerial role, but I wasn't fed. What fed me was the joy of giving. That doesn't last very long for me, you know. I mean, it's lovely, but I needed something coming in. And I fell into Buddhism completely unexpectedly. I wasn't looking for anything else. And when I heard some of the Buddhist precepts, for instance, and I was so taken by them, I was in shock for about a year and a half, because I'd always seen myself as Christian. And this wasn't Christian. And I remember saying to the Lord, "Are you out of your mind? This isn't Christian." And the answer I got was, "Sweetie, trust me. You've hit a glass ceiling. You got to meet this guy. It's the Buddha. It's okay." And, you know, 2 years later, I had to leave the Christian shore and let myself go this way. And it is a path for me of access to a reality that allows you to learn how to live out of indiscriminate compassion and for the benefit of all sentient beings. It's a very high image, actually. But so far for me, it's the only one that sort of satisfies. I wouldn't want to stop short of that, which isn't to say that I will ever achieve it. That isn't the important part. The important part is practicing and trying.
And I noticed you've brought with you some things that you've written and just read me one, and I'd like to hear that now, if you are willing to read it.
Thank you, Brian. Clearly, my house in Amesbury overlooks the Merrimack River. So, as we know, this is not a poem. The mist rises off the river, not to please or delight the eye, not for gain or renown. It rises because the air is cold this October morning, and the river water holds the warmth of lazy, hazy summer days. It rises because it must. And so it is with us. We look deeply with soft, compassionate eyes, because we carry the warmth of non-self deep within. The air of impermanence is cold, and so compassion arises, not for gain or renown, not even for delight, but just because when the cold of impermanence hits the warmth of awareness, compassion arises like mist off the river.
And I noticed you've brought with you some things that you've written and just read me one, and I'd like to hear that now, if you are willing to read it.
Thank you, Brian. Clearly, my house in Amesbury overlooks the Merrimack River. So, as we know, this is not a poem. The mist rises off the river, not to please or delight the eye, not for gain or renown. It rises because the air is cold this October morning, and the river water holds the warmth of lazy, hazy summer days. It rises because it must. And so it is with us. We look deeply with soft, compassionate eyes, because we carry the warmth of non-self deep within. The air of impermanence is cold, and so compassion arises, not for gain or renown, not even for delight, but just because when the cold of impermanence hits the warmth of awareness, compassion arises like mist off the river.
And I wonder if there's any part of our discussion today you want to amplify or wrap up, any final thoughts on this?
Final thoughts. It's a hard one.
Not that this has to be an end, but an end to this particular conversation.
I was just thinking, for me, I keep going away with it, with the need to practice deep listening. The need to practice to deep listening in my own family, with my children and my stepchildren, and with those who are happy with the election results. And I need to have the courage to look at things I don't want to look at, which is, was the election fair and sound and protective of our democratic values, or was it not? I don't want to go near that. I need to go near it. I think I need to be aware. There was a button on a woman that said something like, if you're not enraged, you're not paying attention. And I'm not quite sure I'd go that route, but I think it's a tremendous disservice not to be aware and not to be informed, but to be informed and aware from a place of deep, compassionate listening rather than judgment.
Leonie Luderman, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Thank you, Brian. Thanks.